Welcome to the politicalbetting.com polling matters show. My name is Kieran Pedley. Today we're going to be talking about London. Now, the capital city is important for many reasons, of course, being the capital city. And this in May, we've got the London mayoral election and also the London Assembly elections. But what do we expect to happen and what might the wider implications be for British politics more generally? I'm here to discuss some of these issues with Mike Smithson of politicalbetting.com, Tony Travers of the LSE, and Martin Hoskitch of mayoralwatch.co.uk. Guys, welcome to the show. Martin, I'll start with you. I guess you've been following this very closely on the site and just generally. What are you looking out for in these campaigns?
So far what we've had from Labour is really a bit of a rehash of their general election campaign last year, which itself was a bit of a rehash of Ken's 2012. It's all about cost of living, fares, number of houses, not a lot of originality. Boris is, a bit of a Freudian slip there, but actually Zach is running what is effectively a Boris third term campaign. You know, he's defending Boris's record, he's all about building on it. It's exactly the campaign that you would have got if Boris was running. It looks almost like a sort of understudy performance at times. But what we'll also look at before is the Assembly elections, which is the body that scrutinises the mayor. Last time around, Labour actually got more seats than the Conservatives there, so they were particularly expecting that Ken would win at the last minute because they were picking up seats through the course of the day and have ended up sitting there in opposition for a second time on the Assembly.
I mean, Tony, welcome back to the show. We spoke last year, of course. I guess it's easy when you're looking at elections to get so obsessed by the numbers and who's up and who's down, and you almost ignore the issues at times. I mean, what do you think Londoners are looking at in terms of the key issues in this campaign, whether it's for the Assembly or the mayoral race?
I think what's interesting about this year is that housing is now clearly the most important challenge. London's population is rising, about 100 or 120,000 a year. That means 50, 60,000 more households a year, when perhaps 25, 30,000 homes will be built this year at maximum. Transport, a hardy perennial, used to be the number one issue, but in fact, you know, transport in London has got better. It's better than most parts of the UK. And in that sense, I think it's fallen back a bit as an issue. And I think growing in importance, pollution, city pollution, I think, is now more of an issue than it was. And then more generally, crime, and particularly some aspects of crime, neighbourhood policing, violence on the streets, these are perennial issues. So I think those are the top three or four, really.
I mean, let's look at the London mayoral election. Obviously, has massive political implications, both for the city, but more widely. Mike, I'll bring you in here now. Obviously, the pollsters hesitant to call any race after last May. But what do the polls seem? The polls seem to suggest that Sadiq Khan looks in a good position. But what do you think?
Well, they do. They're giving him leads between about 7% and 10%, and that's would appear to be comfortable. But I'm very nervous about the polling in London. I'm very nervous about polling generally. Remember, remember last time they did get the fact that Boris was going to win, but every single poll completely overstated Boris's position, and if some of them by quite big margins. So I'm nervous about it, because in this election is all about turnout. When you've got turnouts of 35, 36, 37%, it is exceedingly difficult to do accurate polling.
I mean, Martin, I'll bring you in. I mean, one of the things we were talking about off air is that we've had these massive characters, haven't we, as the past two mayors in Ken Livingstone and Boris Johnson. And, you know, arguably the current two frontrunners, Zach Goldsmith and Sadiq Khan, aren't necessarily those strong characters, are they?
That's right. I mean, what's interesting, because last time the divide was, it was just over the 51% that Boris took. And here we're suggesting that two people who are much less well known, the public have taken a much sharper divide. I think I agree with Mike. I'm a bit suspicious about some of the polling. I think also the turnout is very different across London. Some in 2008, there were some wards where turnout was up to 60% and some down into sort of 25-30%. That was the same last time around. It's a huge turnout. So, you know, a uniform sort of predicted turnout of 50% guaranteed, which is overstating what they got last time, by about 12%.
Polls often, you know, overstate turnout, don't they?
They do, but, you know, the differential is what's going to be important, because you're looking at potentially, you know, massively overstating in some areas and understating in the outer boroughs, where a lot of the Tory support is going to be.
Mm. I mean, Tony, what do you make of the London mayoral race?
Well, I mean, certainly the turnout last time with, you know, Ken Livingstone again versus Boris Johnson again, but these huge personalities in London politics, that produced a turnout of 37-38%. So it's going to be lower than that, and more to the point, the first preference votes cast will be a smaller proportion of whatever the total is, meaning second preferences, which are even more complicated to factor in, will almost certainly matter more. So I agree, if it's a very low turnout, remember people will be thinking we're going to vote again in the EU referendum a few weeks after this, then, you know, turnout could make a bigger difference than we're normally expecting it to.
I'm curious about Sadiq Khan's sort of campaign, because I suppose, you know, he was the person, of course, nominated Jeremy Corbyn, and but he's been quite. It seems quite clear that he's trying to distance himself a little bit from the Labour leader at the same time as the Labour leader's homeland, if you like, or sort of home turf is London. I mean, it's a difficult balancing act for him to traverse, isn't it?
It is. He wants to make sure he doesn't lose those outer London votes that are so important. You know, twice as many people live in outer London as inner London, and it's always worth remembering that. And he's got to get, you know, to make sure he doesn't lose them to the Conservative, because it's easier even today, not as easy as it once was, but easy still for the Conservatives today to do well in outer London. I think, on the other hand, as you rightly say, if the momentum surge worked anywhere, it's going to be London. There were large numbers of Green voters in the borough elections 2 years ago, and I see Green voters as a sort of indicator for where momentum voters, new Labour voters might come from. So add all this together, and he does have to, you know, walk a tightrope. But in the end, he's going hard on being pro-business, you know, and he sort of wants to look like a, not exactly a new Labour candidate, but not old new Labour, not new Labour either.
I mean, Mike, you were talking earlier about some of these, I guess, ethnic splits of votes, if that's the correct term to use, that you've been looking at some of the polling around that. I mean, what have you found?
One of the things we find in the latest Comres poll, which came out earlier in the week, is that there's a huge gap if you split it between the white vote and the non-white vote. Mm. And as the chart shows, that we see that if it was white voters alone, then Zach Goldsmith would win by 10-11%. That's what the poll is showing. But if you factor in the non-white element, that is what gives on the polling what gives Khan quite a substantial lead. I don't know how much we can rely on that, but there's some other data from some polling about a year ago, which I found quite interesting, and that is that the Muslim communities, which are quite a significant group, they were turning out, but they were going very strongly for Khan before the process of selecting the candidate. Mm. And we do know in other elections where you've got a Muslim candidate that Muslim communities do get behind their people. So a bit obvious, and there are significant...
I wonder, I mean, we don't have the data here, but I do wonder whether similar patterns would have been shown with Ken versus Boris, maybe. I mean, I know Ken obviously lost, but you know, would the sort of ethnic vote look quite different?
I mean, the results from, you know, deeper analysis of the 2010 general election, we don't have this kind of in-depth analysis yet from 2015, but you'd expect the minority vote to go for Labour. It traditionally has. I mean, the big question I think that still intrigues me about these kind of figures, which are fascinating, is whether some parts of the Indian vote, you know, Indian Hindus, Indian Sikhs, are shifting to the Conservatives over time. I mean, we're going to come on.
Certainly, what Zach's campaign is trying to accelerate.
You know, we're coming on to the question of whether London's a Labour city. But you know, buried in all of that is, will minority and migrant voters always stay with Labour, or will some of the new minorities and new immigrants vote for the Conservatives or shift to the Conservatives over time? And, you know, that's something I think to bear in mind, you know, as we look ahead, not just for this election, you know, that in a sense the minority and migrant voters, who are slightly different groups, some of them overlap, some of them don't, may well be shifting Conservative woods over time. We'll find out.
I mean, let's address that question. I want to come on to London Assembly in a moment, but before we do, this is one of the things that's interested me, and I'd like to get your views on this. I mean, you often hear this phrase that London is a Labour city, in inverted commas, and I suppose the election of Boris Johnson as mayor may contradict that somewhat, but he is his own character, we know. I was looking at the parliamentary seats at the last election. I believe Labour winning almost twice as many, maybe not quite, 45 seats versus the Conservatives, 27, the Lib Dems won. I mean, Martin, what's your view on this? I mean, do you think Sadiq Khan winning the mayoralty would essentially be a revert to the norm, if you like, after...
Well, it's not really the norm, is it? I mean, they've only won once. I mean, you know, you remember Kensler was an independent, he demolished Frank Dobson in 2000. They very nearly came behind the Lib Dems. I mean, it depends on which level you're talking. At a council level, yes, it's a Labour city. At a parliamentary level, yes, it's true now. But it's not true in a pan-London vote. You know, they've come out behind on the Assembly vote more times than not. They've come out behind on the mayoral vote more times than not. So I think it really depends how far you're spreading and what the importance of those votes are to London is turning out.
So I suppose, Tony, that suggests that when voters are looking at a mayor, whether it's in London or elsewhere, actually it's the leadership and the personality that comes through rather than what rosette they're wearing.
Yeah, well, yes. I mean, interestingly, if you look at Greater London, which has now existed in one form or another since 1965, I don't want to go too much history, but the Conservatives won it twice running when they, you know, when the GLC existed in 1967 and 70. So they got, there were 3-year terms, they got 6 years then. Now, if you see Ken Livingstone as a Labour mayor, though he on the first election was fighting as an independent, he won 2 terms, and Boris Johnson has won 2 terms and then stepped down. Whether there's a sort of inbuilt 2 terms party limit operating in London, I mean, we'll find out. I do wonder. I think there's a sort of pendulum issue. London has, if you look at general elections, the London performance by Labour and the London performance by the Conservatives since 1997 has undoubtedly shown Labour overperforming and the Conservatives underperforming. Before 1997, Labour and the Conservatives performed in London almost exactly in the same way as they did across Britain as a whole, and that has changed. So I used to resist this thesis, but I'm now slightly more sympathetic to the idea that London is inching slightly leftwards. I don't think it'll go on forever, but it will go on. It has gone on for a bit.
Let's talk about the London Assembly. I think we've got some data to look at here. Now, Martin, I mean, how much significance would you put on this race? I mean, if we look at over time, I guess the control of the London Assembly seems to have yo-yoed, or at least who the largest party is, seems to have yo-yoed a little bit. Presumably Labour will want to keep their majority. I mean, what do you expect to see in the London Assembly race?
I mean, the majority in the Assembly can be upset. Really where it matters is if the parties and the non-mayoral parties have got 2/3 of the vote, then they can potentially amend the mayor's budget. But even for that to happen, they need to all agree a common position, because they have to pass a fully costed amendment under the City Hall rules. It's not just a case of taking one line out of the mayor's budget or adding something. They've got to make sure that the books balance. That's the rule.
So just to be clear on that, so if the mayor wants a budget, the only way the Assembly can stop him is with 2/3.
Yeah, what they have to do is they have to replace his budget with another budget which is fully costed, fully compliant with local government law, and has the attraction, the backing of 2/3 of the Assembly. So that means all the parties that are non-mayoral parties working together, if they've got the number, which they don't have at the moment. They came close last year when one of the Tory MPs was late. They very nearly got a vote through which could have changed it, but...
One of the interesting things is the electoral system, which is AMS, I believe, which obviously has a combination of the constituencies and a list system to try and bring that element of proportionality to things. I mean, what does that say for the smaller parties' chances? I mean, as a non-London expert, I was curious as to why the smaller parties don't seem to do particularly well, do they?
Well, I mean, what you see is actually a lot of voters are actually quite savvy about the system. So you see in the mayoral vote, and if you compare the mayoral vote share and you compare the Assembly list share, actually the smaller parties get about 50% more on the Assembly list than they get in the mayoral vote. So a lot of voters are already beginning to understand, they're guided a bit by the parties, that there are some bits of the election that they're fighting on that day that they can't win, but on the list vote their vote counts equally across, and that they can get Assembly members on there. And that's, you know, the Greens and the Liberal Democrats are particularly good at getting that message across, that if you vote for us on the Assembly list, we can get in there and we can influence what the mayor does for the next 4 years.
But I'm fascinated by this. I mean, I know we're talking about London today, but as in Scotland, here we've got a voting system which was designed to be more like a proportional representation system. It is broadly proportionate with a cut-off, a 5% cut-off. You have to get 5% to get a seat. And here we've got, in the last election, Labour and the Conservatives winning 21 out of 25 seats. And in Scotland, similarly, it's the system is there. Even though it's a similar system, it produces big great blocks of one party. Now, question, does this mean that the British electorate, born and brought up with first past the post, takes these PR system and then tries to push them back towards something that looks like the first past the post system? I think here, this was slightly forced by the Ken versus Boris choice, and that dragged voters on the Assembly to vote Conservative and Labour, and I think that will fall away again this time. So I think there will be more votes for the Greens, Lib Dems, possibly UKIP, this in 2016 than in this result. So I think it will look more plural, more mixed.
And also, if we look at the 2004 figures, I mean, 2004, the Lib Dems did very well because they had Simon Hughes heading their campaign. He was very well known, you know, one of the few genuinely household name politicians. And of course, UKIP were helped by the fact that they were held on the same day as the Euro election, so their voters were particularly motivated to go out there and vote. The following two elections, the Lib Dems suffered badly because Brian Paddock ran truly terrible campaigns. He was one of the least inspiring candidates ever to run for mayor, and you see every time he stands, he manages to lose them another couple of assembly members. You know, and last time round, because of the way that the votes are counted, they got the very last seat on the assembly. They just edged it above UKIP. Otherwise, Caroline Pidgeon would have sat on her own as a single Lib Dem Assembly member for the last 4 years.
I want to bring Mike in. I haven't forgotten you, Mike. Let's talk a bit about the wider implications of what's happening in London for the rest of the country. You were at the Rawlings and Thrasher, conference or presentation the other day. I mean, what were you sort of learning at that?
Well, every year, Colin Rawlings and Michael Thrasher, they produce two serious numbers ahead of the local elections. One of them is their predictions of the vote shares, and the other is their prediction of the council loss, the seat losses and gains. And this is absolutely hated by the political parties because it destroys any effort of expectations management. You know, people now think, well, the Tories have got to make 50 gains, and if they don't make 50 gains, well, they've underperformed. But the way they do it, they base this on regularly monitoring all the local by-elections that take place every Thursday night throughout the year. And they create sort of vote share projections from that and apply it. And it's been a relatively good guide. What is fascinating is that this year on seats, Labour is projected to lose seats overall in the local elections.
And the last time was a high bar, wasn't it?
In 2012, that was after weeks after George Osborne's first Omni-Shambles budget. And Labour was absolutely soaring and got nearly 40% national vote share. This time things are a little bit different, and that's been shown. But I think historically, you've got to go back to 1982 to find a non-general election year where the main opposition party lost seats in the local elections. And if that's happening, that's bad news for Labour.
I mean, Tony, you've been looking at local elections over a long period of time. I mean, what do you make of this? Does this feel a sensible projection? What would be the implications if it was?
Well, I agree very much with what Mike has just said. I mean, I do think, though, I think the London election is a fascinating race, and it's wonderfully combative, and you know, these figures will tell us more about the underlying condition of British politics, is the honest truth. And you know, if Labour gets only 30% of the national equivalent vote share 1 year out from a general election, when the Conservatives in one form or another have been in power for 6 years, that is a pretty bleak result for them. And as Mike says, if they lose seats in this condition, you know, Conservatives are not having the greatest time at the moment, after all. You know, that will just be a very bad signal. And you know, to win the next general election, the opposition party has to be scoring high in the national equivalent vote share all the way through from this election to next. That's the evidence of the past, and 30 is not good.
And the projected vote share actually shows UKIP up 7 points, up to 12. So, I mean, maybe we're ignoring UKIP at the moment, but, I mean, they might be in for a good night, potentially.
They might. I mean, broadening is well away from London. I've always been intrigued by what would happen in those parts of urban England, many of them in the north, in big cities, where the Labour Party is dominant and where there's no chance of the Conservatives or the Lib Dems apparently really fighting into that? Could UKIP break through in some of those places? So I think we'll, you know, we'll test that a bit. Where UKIP does well in local elections will give us some further clues as to the future of British politics and, of course, the future of UKIP.
But UKIP, it has to be said, are performing nothing like the way they were performing a year ago. And the sort of the 12%, that's about half what they were getting in the 6 months before the general election. So that they have, they are markedly down.
I mean, an interesting juxtaposition, perhaps, is that, you know, Sadiq Khan winning the London mayoralty, if we assume that he's going to, and I know, and we'll come into a minute what we think people might happen there. If he does win the mayoralty, that will help Jeremy Corbyn, presumably, Mike. Because obviously, you know, it's, he hasn't lost everywhere. At the same time, then there's a by-election in Tooting, and that could very much hinder Jeremy Corbyn, couldn't it?
Oh, indeed. I mean, it's the Tooting by-election is something that political anoraks like me really look forward
to. There aren't as many as there used to be, aren't there,
indeed,
by-elections? Everybody's more healthy these days.
You get the fight over the Labour nomination will be quite something. There's already hints that Ken Livingstone might has got his eye on it, and that will be a great battle. And it would be an interesting fight.
I mean, Tony, what do you make of Tooting? I must admit, I completely overestimated in my mind what the majority was there for Sadiq Khan. I had it in 7,000 or 8,000, and of course, it's what is it, 2,500, 3,000?
It's quite marginal.
Winnable for the Tories, really?
Well, I mean, that part of South London ought to be winnable. I mean, the Conservatives in some parts of London have been declining, and this is part of a wider story. But this would be, I mean, this, if this by-election came to pass, it would be a war of all against all, really, wouldn't it? Because it would involve a huge struggle within the Labour Party to select a candidate, and then an enormous sort of war by proxy about, you know, what this means for the future of British politics, as Mike says. So, you know, the consequence of voting on in the mayoral election is which of two by-elections, which of, I mean, presumably there'd have to be one in Richmond, it's that Goldsmith one. So, you know, that too would be interesting in a different way. So these things have consequences well beyond the, you know, the London mayoral election.
The Tooting seat is the seat that borders where I live in Battersea, actually, and the Tories have already got a candidate lined up. I mean, Dan Watkins, who stood for them last time, is, I think, probably almost certain to stand if Sadiq ends up winning and stepping down there. And he's been really very busy. I mean, he's busy during election. He's acting very much as a sort of community campaigner, campaigning on things like the Crossrail stations. He's been really sort of raising his profile. So I think that they probably have a very good chance, because he's probably, unless they do end up running again for Labour Party, chances are he's probably going to be a lot better known locally than whoever Labour field. Whereas if you sort of talk to the Lib Dems, they don't really have very much expectation of winning back Richmond Park after that performance last year.
I know that the Conservatives, I don't have a close friend of mine, senior CCHQ, saying they do not want a by-election in Richmond Park. And the reason they don't want that, they don't want the Lib Dems in any form whatsoever to appear to be gaining a bit of traction.
Now, I think this is an really interesting issue, again, for broader politics in Britain. If we remember back in 2011 and 2012, when we first got signals about how the falling away of the Liberal Democrat vote in coalition was beginning to affect British politics, because actually the Conservatives, I remember, the Conservatives didn't do as badly as I thought they were going to do at that time. And it was partly because the way the Liberal Democrat votes were going away had a particular effect, which actually, it turned out, was a helpful predictor of what was going to happen in the general election. So if those votes start to go back now, if those Liberal Democrat votes start to go back to the Lib Dems, and the by-elections are not bad for them, actually, looking at the local by-elections, question, would that have a negative effect on the Conservatives? And I can see how it might. I mean, if it's just reversing what happened 4 or 5 years ago, it might. So I can see why the Conservatives would very much like not to have a by-election in a Conservative Lib Dem marginal.
And let's close on...
It's not very marginal at the moment in Venice, but it could be.
I mean, let's close, and there's a lot of punters watch this and listen to the show, and let's close on sort of looking at that. I'll go through each of you in turn. I mean, who do we think is going to win the mayoralty, and if there was a by-election in Tooting or Richmond, do we think the incumbent would hold it? I'll start with you, Martin.
You know, I'm going to be the guy who says I think there's still a good chance that might win. I'm sure that Sadiq is ahead. All the polls show he's ahead. It's about how much, and I'm distrustful of the numbers. You know, they all inflate, overstate the turnout. I think they all probably understated.
Distrust the polls?
I mean, I don't want to get into the lazy day wrong last year, but they overstate the turnout. They're overstating turnout about 13% more than they actually Ken and Boris managed to get. They're, I think, probably underrepresenting the number of votes the smaller party's going to get, which means that they're working out second preferences from a much smaller pool than what happened in real world. And they often force people to make a choice between the two leading candidates, which isn't the choice that people make in the ballot box. And people cast their second preference votes for a whole wide region. You know, people who vote for
Caroline, not at all.
They may not cope with it, or people who vote for Caroline Pidgeon, the Liberal Democrat candidate, will say, well, actually, I want her, but I'd really like a lady mayor, so I'm going to vote for Sean Berry, the Green candidate. So people cast their second preference on a whole range of very legitimate ways that doesn't represent that sort of forced choice that the pollsters tend to give. So I think it's still possible that Zach could win. I think he needs to probably sort of up it a bit. There's not a lot of urgency. You don't see the same sort of desperation as you do with...
He's very laid back, isn't he?
He is incredibly laid back. I mean, that's what he's like if you interview him, you know. Yeah. But I think it comes across possibly as a sort of academic, well, I'd maybe quite like to be mayor, but it doesn't matter too much if I'm not, and I think that can play against him. In terms of policy, it's not a huge difference between them, really, apart from the fares pledge. You know, so the massive fares pledge, which he says will cost about $450 million. CFL say it costs about $1.9 billion. That's really the big row between the two of them. But yeah, otherwise, I don't think London will look much different whether Sadiq wins. You know, in 2020, I don't think London will look much different whether Sadiq wins or Zach, to be honest.
But are you saying you expect Zach to win, or you just think he might?
I think if he does win, I'll be the least surprised person in London, but I'm not predicting that he will. I just think that it's far more likely than most people think it is.
So Martin's off on the fence. Tony?
No, well, they were all scarred by last year, and, you know, I mean, I think, in fairness to the opinion polls in London, you know, notwithstanding Mike's qualification at the beginning, they've sort of got the result right in the past. So, you'd have to say, looking at everything we can see in front of us, what happened in the general election last year, what happened in the boroughs a year before that, what happened, what the polls are showing, it's kind of Labour's to lose. But that, you know, these days, things can change quickly. You know, will the Conservatives try to play a sort of EU referendum by proxy campaign towards the end of the campaign, that, or something new, something we haven't thought about, may not be that, something else, something might happen, you know. So I too would always sit on the fence these days with elections. It's just safer and more, even on the surface, on the edge of the fence, more comfortable. As far as the by-elections are concerned, if Labour came up with an against-type hyper-moderate candidate for Tooting, if it was them, then I think they probably would say, everybody would say, well, this is interesting. That might be much, you know, much more winnable. And for the Conservatives, if it was them, you know, having to fight Richmond Park, I mean, Zach does have quite a big majority, though a lot of it may be personal, I mean, more than is normally the case. And either would be, a nightmare for party managers, whichever sets it was.
I mean, one thing that's just come to mind, actually, which we haven't discussed, is something that always comes up when there's a minority candidate, for want of a better phrase, such as Sadiq Khan. I mean, do we think that there's a potential for voters sort of quietly turning away from him because of that? Is it the Bradley effect?
Yes.
Martin,
I think there is. I mean, I think there is that. I think there's a potential that some
London's
people...
London's supposed to be a liberal city.
Absolutely. But, you know, and yet if you look at the Comrades poll that they did for the BBC last week, immigration is one of the big concerns, you know, not transport, housing, immigration, security and health. So, I mean, there is the potential that some people are worried that they're going to look like a racist if they say they won't vote for him. So it's possible that he's being overstated in the polls for that. Or there's a potential that the sort of message that the Tories have been trying to get out there of trying to link him with, you know, quite tenuously, really, you know, trying to link him with sort of radicals and extremists, possibly at the last minute, that may just possibly at the end when people get into the ballot box and they see the name on a paper, perhaps that will just deter people at the last minute. But I mean, the other things we haven't really discussed Tony touched a bit on the Greens. I mean, if you look at the other thing it might do for Sadiq, I think a bit, is if you look at sort of some of the council cutbacks have been really unpopular. One of the things, if you follow the Green candidate, Sean Berry, on Twitter, she's made a very strong effort to go out there and be seen with every single group of protesters, the library protesters, the demonstrators are taking over council buildings. She's been out there sort of being the anti-austerity candidate. Now, Sadiq can't do that because he's been trying to position himself as a sort of centrist moderate Labour candidate, so he's trying to distance herself from Corbyn. But actually what she may be able to do is peel back some of those green-minded supporters who went off and voted for Corbyn in the leadership election. She may be able to bring some of them back and bolster up their assembly vote.
And I want to finish with Mike, but Tony, but briefly on that Bradley effect idea, I mean, is that something that you'd be concerned about if you're in a Sadiq Khan campaign or not?
Clearly, let's not be naive. There has been an outbreak of, within living memory, an outbreak of BNP voting in London. So, there are parts of London where there is the potential for that kind of voting to occur. That's been dampened down again subsequently by the Labour Party kind of getting its act together. I think on the other hand, London is also a city of progressives. There's another large vote of people who are, even though London is the richest part of the UK, we've already been discussing being shifting to the left politically. Now, and this is true, New York's always been a bit like that. Paris is like that too these days. So, it's possible that some people would think, having a minority mayor would actually be part of London's global self-image, really. Mm-hmm. We'd quite like to send that signal to the... So that might tip it back the other way. So I think that this will be, honestly, less of an issue. I think politics in Britain... I've always been fascinated by the homogeneity of the Conservative Party, the Labour Party, the Lib Dems, and frankly, most of the parties. Generally fights against being too segmented in its appeal. They like to think of themselves as broad churches and coalitions. Mm. So in that sense, I think it will have less effect. I think British politics has been, thus far, reasonably immune from some of the baleful effects of segmenting the electorate into groups and then that becoming a basis for appeal. So I think I go for it not actually turning to have much of an effect.
I mean, Mike, final word to you. Any predictions you'd make?
Having bet a three-figure sum on Sadiq Khan in March 2013, after he'd been appointed shadow minister for London.
Standing by your man.
I'm standing by my man because I'll be several thousand pounds up if it comes up. So.
Well, very good. Well, thank you to Martin and to Tony and to Mike for your input. Really interesting discussion. Certainly lots to keep an eye out for in the race to May. Sadiq Khan looks like he's in the lead, but as we've mentioned, there's all to play for, certainly in the mayoral race and in the London Assembly too. And of course, the implications are much wider for Jeremy Corbyn's leadership of the Labour Party and British politics more generally. That's all for part one of this show. Join us in a moment when Mike and I will be talking about events across the pond. Welcome back to the politicalbetting.com polling matters show. My name is Kieran Pedley. Well, in the final part of the show, Mike and I will be talking about the US election and the result in Wisconsin last night. It certainly felt like Wisconsin had a sort of important place on the calendar, particularly on the GOP side. It was 2 weeks ago when Arizona and Utah voted in the GOP race, and it'll be 2 weeks again until we see the vote in the New York primary. So what do we make of last night's results? Of course, Donald Trump floundering a little bit, losing to Ted Cruz in that contest. And on the Democrat side, Bernie Sanders emerged victorious over Hillary Clinton, raising the question once again, could he be a more viable candidate for nomination than we might once have thought? Mike, I'll bring you in. I mean, what did you think? Certainly, Cruz and Sanders were the big winners last night, weren't they?
Oh, indeed. There's no doubt that from the polling and against expectations, the victory that Cruz got was substantially larger than people were expecting. And in fact, remember that one poll came out the day before from ARG and was predicting a 10% lead for Trump. So it was a big victory, and a big victory because the demographics are not entirely suitable for Cruz. I mean, one would expect one would have expected that he would have struggled there. The problem I think that Trump has got now is that one of momentum. We've been having every Tuesday night since the start of February, a new great big boost for. boost for Trump. And we've gone for a period of 2 weeks without a primary. We've got another 2 weeks before the next primary, and Wisconsin sits on its own. Mm. Wisconsin also is very significant because of the way it allocates delegates, and of the 42 delegates I think the state has, I think just three of them will be going to Donald Trump. That compares with the Democratic race, where of course their distribution of delegates is much more proportional, and the effect of that is that although Hillary lost again, she is still pretty well ahead on delegates and doesn't look in trouble.
I mean, let's deal with the Democrats briefly, because I mean I think we're both of a similar view. I think that although Bernie Sanders is doing far better than I think anyone would have given him credit for back in August or September, the reality is because of the way that delegates are allocated, she looks in a good position to get the nomination, doesn't it?
Oh yes, she? Yeah. I mean, it is very hard to see that him not see him getting and doing anything to stop Hillary.
I mean, let's talk about the Republican race, which seems to be where the action is. Seems like it's been that way all the way through the contest. A lot of the headlines now are very negative for Donald Trump, suggesting that there'll be a contested convention and he might miss out. I mean, what's your take on that?
Well, I think he needs to get to his 1,237 delegates in order to secure the nomination, to be absolutely safe on that. The question is, we're into really uncharted territory if he doesn't do that, and are we going to get into a convention where there's a massive fight, where the votes are inconclusive, we have a series of votes, and could we even see somebody else come in? I mean, one of the things in the betting that's been very marked has been the House Speaker Paul Ryan, who is vice presidential candidate on the Romney ticket last time, and people are starting to talk. Well, could he be the one who could actually solve the problem? He is also the chairman of the convention, which puts him in a position. I really don't know. It's very hard to predict it. And I know that you were arguing on political betting the other day that if it goes there, that it has to be Cruz. It doesn't have to be anybody else.
Well, yeah. I mean, my view, as I explain in the piece, and maybe people listening or watching this will have read it, is that what is technically possible, and it is technically possible that somebody else emerges, and what is politically deliverable are probably two different things. And I think even if you were any Democrat, I don't mean in terms of the Democratic Party, but just someone that believes in democracy, surely any self-respecting Democrat would say, look, they've had 6 months or so of caucuses and primaries, millions of people have been to the polls, they've overwhelmingly backed Donald Trump and Ted Cruz. And I think actually one of the overlooked aspects of this campaign is not so much the Trump surge, but the fact that collectively the Republican Party has gone for Trump and Cruz and what that says about the establishment. The idea that in that scenario we end up with somebody else is surely would be toxic to the party. And I think that, you know, conversely, actually, if you look at Ted Cruz, I don't think that there should be much celebration or dancing in the aisles with any progressive or any centrist person at the prospect of him getting the nomination. But I can just about buy Ted Cruz, supported by Kasich and Rubio and their sort of delegates and maybe some unpledged delegates, doing a deal. But the idea that Donald Trump doesn't get it, Ted Cruz doesn't get it, and then somebody else does feels very, very unlikely to me. I think one other point I would make is that there is a risk in this gap, which you talked about, where we've got to wait 2 weeks now until New York, and we've had 2 weeks until the previous primaries and caucuses. There's a very real risk that we almost overcompensate for what's happened to Donald Trump. He still has a massive delegate lead. You know, ultimately, he's not going to be surpassed by anybody. I don't think the map looks favourable enough to Ted Cruz, for example, for him to be able to lead on delegates. So if we accept that Trump is going to have the most votes, the most states, and the rule that says you have to have 8 states to actually win the nomination, which may or may not be changed, then it is Trump versus Cruz. And Trump does have, whether you like the way he's got there in terms of some of his rhetoric and some of the things he's said, he does have a very democratically legitimate claim to the nomination, and it's going to be interesting to see what happens.
Yeah, indeed. And I think the Hillary Clinton will be absolutely delighted to face Donald Trump rather than somebody else. I respect that view. I just you can see a situation where It is the Cleveland Convention in July is completely chaotic, and it goes on for days and cliffhangers and everything, and out is dragged Paul Ryan, you know,
begrudgingly
to save the party, and I think that's sort of scenario. Certainly, when Stan Greenberg on your podcast last. November,
yes.
Made that prediction. I put a bet on Paul Ryan at 200-1. So I'm sort of slightly.
Well, this is the secret. I just merely begrudge the fact that I ignored him at the time, and here I am just moaning about the democratic illegitimacy.
Yeah, your argument's sound. I think it is very hard to see how it can be other than Trump in those situations. Mm. But who knows? I mean, because he has upset so many within the party, and he has the worst favorability ratings of any major party contender since polling started.
Mm. And who knows, if the rules are there and the potential is there, then anything can indeed happen. And Mike, thanks for your time. And that's all we've got time for this week's episode of the PoliticalBetting.com Polling Matters show. A big thanks to my guests earlier, Tony Travis and Martin Hosnick, and their views on London. And of course, a big thank you again to Mike Smithson. I'll be off for the next couple of weeks on my jaunts, on my holidays. But stay tuned for more episodes of the Political Betting Polling Matters show in my absence. Stay tuned.